The church's mission, he insisted, wasn't in Germantown or in Chestnut Hill. It was among the people, the poor, and the needy especially, right here. And civil war did not deter Dorr in that mission. He knew slavery was wrong, and he sought to grow this church in the crucible of this place. And so he sought to maintain fellowship with conservative, pro-slavery unionists who constituted a bloc as weighty and powerful in this church then as they were in the fractious union coalition at large. Nothing divided Dorr's congregation as it divided also the nation and the North, particularly this, the Keystone State, as much as Lincoln's measured steps toward emancipation. Pennsylvania's Copperhead Democrats, led by these men in this church, openly scorned emancipation in the most racist terms. In early 1863, they established Philadelphia's Central Democratic Club to defend the proposition among, and I quote, the pure principles of democracy that in the state of Pennsylvania, all power is inherent in the white people. Fanning popular prejudices and fears, these copperheads curdled the cream of Philadelphia society. They actively obstructed efforts to raise troops to defeat the rebellion, and they thought slaveholding Southerners very fine people. They sought armistice with them. On the other hand, Republicans in Dorr's church, in December of 1862, they founded the nation's first Union League, followed soon after by union clubs in New York and in Boston and elsewhere throughout the North. And those clubs worked to mobilize support for Lincoln's prosecution of the war, and most controversially, to lobby the Lincoln administration and rally popular support for the enlistment of black soldiers in the Union's armed forces. Horace Binney, a renowned Philadelphia sage, and a jurist as renowned then as Joseph Story and Daniel Webster. He endorsed the League here in Philadelphia as, quote, a refuge for loyalty to the Union. Horace Binney was the Reverend Dorr's most steadfast friend and godfather to his son, Captain William White Dorr. Another historian has criticized Dorr for refusing to speak on the divisive issues of his day, particularly slavery and secession, but she was mistaken. It's true that Dorr refrained from maligning slaveholders. He neither preached abolition nor vilified slave owners and those South and North who supported slavery and openly espoused white supremacy. But he denounced slavery. He lamented its grip in and on America, and he challenged pro-slavery theology. His tact was not equivocation. He did not twist, conceal, or cloud the truth, and he directly denounced secession as rebellion, monstrous rebellion, he called it. I was initially surprised, one reader wrote to me, at the choice of Benjamin Dorr for your extended examination, thinking instead of many abolitionists who asserted their views much more clearly. That's a fair point. One also made by an African-American gentleman who pointedly asked after a talk that I gave 3 years ago right here, is the Reverend Dorr really worthy of our esteem today? I grant the gentleman's point about Dorr's diplomacy, but consider the consequence if Dorr had instead preached abolition. I don't think we'd be meeting now in the nation's church, or in the United States for that matter, as both places would have torn asunder 150 years ago. Dorr could not then preach abolition and keep his historic American church intact. Neither could Lincoln, by demanding immediate abolition, hold the nation together and set slavery on a course of ultimate extinction. I want to be careful not to make a saint of Benjamin Dorr or to undervalue the indispensable roles abolitionists played in making America a more perfect union, particularly concerning the advancement of American liberty. After all, our first African-American president wrote this: "The best I can do in the face of our history is remind myself that it has not always been the pragmatist, the voice of reason, or the force of compromise that has created the conditions for liberty. The hard, cold facts remind me that it was men like Frederick Douglass who recognized that power would concede nothing without a fight." And yet, what Obama then said of Lincoln, and particularly of Lincoln's more diplomatic anti-slavery stance, holds true for Benjamin Dorr as well. Obama then went on to say this: "I like to believe that for Lincoln, it was a matter of maintaining within himself the balance between two contradictory ideas, that we must talk and reach for common understandings, precisely because all of us are imperfect and can never act with the certainty that God is on our side. And yet, at times, we must act nonetheless, as if we are certain, protected from error only by providence." Reverend Dorr fully supported the war as Lincoln waged it, for union and for measured steps towards emancipation. Holding true to his unionist and anti-slavery principles without antagonizing the divisions that threatened the existence of his church, Dorr preached for emancipation indirectly. He used biblically allusive terms. He preached in parables. And I'm going to give you two examples. In July of 1862, just as his son volunteered as a Union infantry officer with the 121st Pennsylvania, the Reverend Dorr donated $100, which was a large sum of money in those days, to Philadelphia's Bounty Fund for volunteers. And he preached that Sunday on the biblical psalm, "I will pay my vows." Now, I'm sure that everyone in the church that day, Republicans and Democrats alike, would have known what Dorr meant. The time had come for him to speak and to act openly against the rebellion and its wrongful cause. "Now," Dorr declared, in the very week that Lincoln had signed the Second Confiscation Act, that it decidedly turned the war toward emancipation, "now," Dorr said, "I will pay my vows now." And then, with a father's and a pastor's Godspeed, as one of Dorr's close friends later said, he blessed his son's enlistment in that holy cause. I'm going to read a short excerpt from my book, another example of the Reverend Dorr's tact and the way that he spoke in parables. As did Lincoln, by the way, right? Whose parables, his were earthy and homespun, but they also were grounded in the Bible, artfully composed for a citizenry that was largely Christian and working class. So, for example, here is Dorr preaching on Thanksgiving Day in 1863, the first national day of Thanksgiving that had been proclaimed by President Lincoln. Dorr preached that day on the biblical story of elderly King David's thanksgiving to God for the Israelites' victory over their enemy. David's first thoughts, the rector proposed, quote, would naturally run back to the day of the declaration of their independence, rather the day of their emancipation, when their forefathers, 600,000 strong with their wives and children and household goods, left their house of bondage and set forward to the promised land, unquote. And Dorr urged his parishioners to thank God for, quote, our own beloved country, so much like the signally blessed land he gave to the Jews. Dorr saw God's hand at work at Gettysburg. He said, quote, how signally has God interposed to keep far away from us the most direful calamities of war, when a powerful rebel invasion threatened the devastation of our own fair state and the destruction of our property and our homes. Our gallant soldiers endured with superhuman strength, drove back the ruthless invaders, and delivered us from all our fear. And recall that his son was right in the thick of that. As we look around upon our land this day, although a dense dark cloud hangs heavily over it, and many fair fields are laid waste, and many homes are desolate, and many hearts are sorrowing over the death of dear ones, yet with all the woes brought upon our bleeding country by this monstrous rebellion, what a multitude of mercies, civil, social, and religious, bestowed upon us the past year may be reckoned to counterbalance these. But Dorr did more that day than celebrate God's blessings on the Union. He gave thanks for the dawning of a new order, the growing understanding among, quote, these are his words, tens of thousands of men and women in our land, that it is more blessed to give than to receive. Never, he ventured, was there a more beautiful illustration of true Christian charity, the greatest of all gifts and graces, than we behold everywhere around us this day. This is God's work. His grace moves the heart to deeds of mercy, unquote. Now, what deeds of mercy and charity could Dorr have meant? Blooming everywhere around them in the savage blight of war and involving tens of thousands of men and women. It's possible it was referring to ministrations to sick and wounded soldiers. Appeals resounded throughout the North among almost all parties for donations of time and resources in aid of convalescing soldiers. But Dorr seemed to call his flock to something more, inviting them to empathetic mindfulness of God's first chosen people who had been enslaved, and to reflect especially on, quote, the day of their emancipation, 600,000 strong. How could Dorr not have been calling his parishioners to reflect also on the emancipation that year of 3 million people in Civil War America? Dorr's invocation of King David's thanksgiving to God subtly recalled Lincoln's dedication of a Gettysburg cemetery just 7 days earlier, when the president's thoughts, like King David's, had run back to the Americans' Declaration of Independence. Associating the American Declaration with the Jews' declaration of their independence and the day of their emancipation, Dorr elusively underscored Lincoln's resolution that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom. Dorr enjoined the nation's church to pray as King David did, with humility of heart, that, quote, winged his prayer up to high heaven, and with words which Dorr underlined in his sermon, that there may be no decay, no leading into captivity. 18 months later, preaching on the National Day of Fasting and Prayer for the assassinated president, Dorr would use this parable again. This time he likened Lincoln to Moses, who led the Jews from their enslavement in Egypt. And what a glorious redemption was this, Dorr exclaimed. More than 3 millions of souls, 600,000 men with their wives and children, marching at midnight from the land of their captivity. I don't think there's any doubt that he was speaking there in favor of emancipation. Door sermons like Lincoln's speeches and private correspondence exemplify an exceptionally temperate faith, apart from the partisan appropriation of civil religion with which most Americans then, let's face it, they crusaded against each other. Americans had come to view themselves not only as a chosen people, but as God's chosen nation. Rival visions of the nation's manifest destiny, though, divided those self-professed chosen peoples and brought them to blows. Dissenting from that tribal crusading, Lincoln spoke instead of Americans as God's almost chosen people. He rejected zealotry on both sides, abolitionism, particularly abolitionist violence, on the one side, and Bible-thumping advocacy of slavery's godliness on the other. In his second inaugural address, Lincoln rebuked both sides. Both read the same Bible and pray to the same God, Lincoln lamented, and each invokes his aid against the other. Door two, he deplored the hubris on both sides, the righteous certainty with which each side claimed to know absolutely the mind of God. He, like Lincoln, hove instead to the Calvinist tenet of God's almighty and inscrutable ways, and he preached a gospel of charity and compromise, principled compromise. He prayed that war might be avoided and that slavery would cease to grow, eventually ending altogether. And he drew artfully from the Bible in search of common ground, where Americans of good faith might come to stand together. That's a middle ground position, and the uneasy balance of that position gives us pause, gives me pause. Critics in Lincoln's and Door's day, and in history,